Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Carl Carlson.
And my name's Chris Jackson. And Carl and I were actually just talking about something my wife made me watch on Netflix last night. And it was, if anyone's heard of Marie Kondo, she is a Japanese lady who specializes in tidying. And she's actually, she's actually a worldwide phenomenon. She's doing very well for herself, which was news to me when I was forced to watch this 45 minutes of domestic entertainment last night. But it did trigger something in my mind, which is always focused on reliability engineering, and that is something about her approach. The first step of her approach involves finding what it is in your house that you are trying to tidy, so, for example, clothes, and then you going and getting every single piece of clothing you have and putting it on your bed or in the same place, so you can see this mountain of material, which essentially becomes the scope of your wardrobe without you knowing it. And there's something very important about the visual that provides. You really understand how much stuff you have, and a lot of the time that initiates change. And the parallel I was thinking when I saw this as it relates to reliability engineering was how organizations can often hide the problems and effects of poor reliability. Effectively, they put all their reliability problems in the closets of their organization and hide them away so they don't have to see them on a daily basis and they don't feel bad about these problems. And therefore, their house always stays untidy because they have so many clothes, or in the case of the reliability engineering professional, their product is always unreliable because on a day-to-day basis, they never have to face up the problems of not taking reliability seriously. And it's a long bow, I know, but for whatever reason, it struck a chord with me. And I was wondering if Carl felt the same, or if he had any similar experiences to the epiphany I had last night.
I sure have. I've believed for a long time that making things visible is the right way to work. So, for instance, when I'm doing an FMEA, we'll take all the pre-work and make sure it's visible. Get it up on projectors, get it on a chart, get it on a blackboard somewhere. Although I am dating myself when I talk about chalkboards. And just get it out in the open. I remember years back at GM, we went through this fairly extensive training called Lean Engineering. It was when Lean Engineering got first introduced. Mm-hmm. And one of the principles there was to make things visible. And so I think that's a great point. And of course, the converse of it is what happens when things are invisible. And really, a lot of the habits and what goes on in an organization is below the surface. And people have the ways they've done things, the specifications, the techniques that they use to design. A lot of this is not out in the open. Some of it's up in people's heads, that type of thing. So I think there's a terrific amount of benefit by applying the principles that you were describing and getting things out in the open. Mm-hmm. So that's my general comment.
And if you don't get the problems out in the open, it means that when you do see a problem, if you do see that, the odd T-shirt lying on the ground or what have you, if you put it in the laundry hamper, sure, you've solved that problem in that day. But the true underlying root cause, which is a wardrobe whose chronology can be traced back to the 1960s, is taking up every single closet in your house in the spare bedroom, that problem never gets addressed. So you can still do these little tiny things which, yes, make you feel good about it when you're doing it, also don't require a lot of resource expenditure at the time, but will inevitably not solve the problem, and you'll be heartbroken when or frustrated when the next shirt appears from nowhere and is lying on the floor in the same place.
Yeah. So, I mean, good analogy. There's this term and concept called hidden factory, as an example, where a lot of the wastes are come about from the factory that's below the surface. And so that's another concept that gets applied. I'm thinking of the Pareto principle, Chris, as well, where Pareto, when he was doing his experiments in gardening, discovered that the 80-20 principle and so much of what is important is hidden by other things. I'll just tell you a story here that comes to mind. I'm thinking back years ago, back in the 80s, I managed a door testing group in automotive. And I asked for the door warranty. So up comes this printout. And back then it was the ones with the little holes in the sides, you know, and the folding paper.
Dot matrix printers, yep.
Yeah, yeah. It was about a foot high of paper, all folded over in tiny print. And here's the door problems from a warranty. And it occurred to me, I asked the wrong question, because I should have asked, what are the top 10 door problems? Mm-hmm. Not what is every door problem that's ever happened? Yeah. And so seeing what the characterized as the forest for the trees is very important. Being able to understand what is most important out of the masses of things. What clothes do you really need, as opposed to what have you ever owned? What are the special characteristics, as opposed to all characteristics? This is a really important part of reliability, is to be able to differentiate things that are important from things that are unimportant. We have a couple scales that are used in risk management. If you go to the ISO standards, you'll find these very easily. But one of them is severity. That means how severe is something. And the other is frequency or occurrence. How often does it happen? And then those come together. And you can use tools like fault tree analysis or probabilistic risk assessment to understand the real risk involved in any event or situation. This involves being able to see differences, what's more important than things that are less important. So I'm going on a bit, but it really struck home with me on your story about the tying.
Yeah, and when I talk to clients or I talk to people who are struggling with this concept, I say exactly the same thing, but the words I use is you've got to find the vital few and not the trivial thousands, because the trivial thousands can overwhelm you and, more importantly, make you feel like you're doing something good by resolving something that was hardly likely to happen, or if it was going to happen, had barely little impact. And by not focusing on the vital few, you know, instead looking at the trivial thousands, it gives you a chance, as the human being we all are, to cherry pick the things that are easy for you or the things that you're experienced in solving. So you're not focusing on the things that you need to do to improve reliability. You're focused on, quite literally, a very personal KPI. And organizations, regardless of what tools they use, I'd argue throughout the developments and use of a product, need to have this constantly updated list of vital few failure mechanisms and what their plan is to address them, and hopefully have them replaced by the next most significant failure mechanism and address that and keep going and keep going. You'll never get through them all, but you will have a seriously reliable product at the other end.
So you're living the Pareto principle.
Exactly.
And I think a good podcast for me is where I'm learning while talking. And I think that's a good conversation.
Exactly.
And I really look for that in every conversation. So I'm having some learnings here that I'm thinking about. And one of them is, how can we use the vital few to improve our reliability practice? And so I'm just sort of off the top of my head, I'm thinking about the application of special characteristics. And a while back, and I'm going to say about 10 years ago, I was on site with a client that was making electronic devices. And they had taken this to a very mature level. Their reliability flow down of requirements flowed down to special characteristics. It did not just flow down to numbers. So they started at the system level, and so they might have had a certain number of problems per whatever that was a requirement at a system, or a certain percentage of a problem per the overall population. And then they would allocate that to subsystems. But by the time they got down to components, they were looking for not just a reliability number, but specific product and ultimately process characteristics that, if achieved, they would get the reliability at the system level. And it was a very interesting, mature type of reliability allocation.
Absolutely. And it does sound like an organization that essentially gets it. Especially if there's that, let's call it systemic focus on system reliability characteristics. That's essentially all you want to do, is just focus on what it means for the customer.
Right, right. I'll tell a story here that I use sometimes in my tutorials that illustrates this point. Back when I was doing door testing, we used to test every time there was a new program. We would test what's called the door impact beam. Mm-hmm. The door impact beam is a very simple device that sits between the inner and the outer panels, and it helps guard against side intrusions, side car accidents. And of course, it has a force deflection mm-hmm. requirement. So we'd dutifully put the door impact beam onto a couple blocks, and then in the middle of it, push down and measure the force deflection to see if it met the requirements. So we would do that with sample size. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd have a reliability requirement and you'd have to do a certain number of samples. Let's think about that for a minute, because it occurred to us, and this is back in the 1980s, it occurred to us that if we controlled the diameter or the cross-section, depending on what the cross-section looks like, and we controlled the material composition, we've essentially defined the force deflection metric or property. So we said, well, let's try that. So we did it for about a year. Mm-hmm. We were very safe. We would dutifully test the door impact beams. And meanwhile, someone else would do the analysis and calculate the force deflection. And sure enough, it calibrated very nicely. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we could drop out the physical testing by characterizing the special characteristics, or identifying the special characteristics and holding those. And so the product could be defined by special characteristics, and then the process. So what type of tooling would you need if you're doing tooling to form that beam, or if you're rolling it, what type of pressure, if you're whatever the process is, there's certain characteristics that will achieve the desired product characteristics. So just an interesting way to achieve reliability without necessarily the traditional means.
Exactly. And I think that really what I'm hearing from what you're talking about, Carl, is it just simplifies the process. As in, it's one thing to say to someone, go and make something that's reliable. And in some cases, you have to say that. But then that person then needs to go away and independently analyze, okay, what do I need to do to make this thing reliable? But if you can tell someone this is what you need to do to make it reliable, then that's actually a lot more very specific information about what that person needs to do. And if these tasks or these things or these processes have been determined by a group of really smart people, then you get the benefit of those smart decisions for all your products that are manufactured here and hereafter. It just gives a lot of very specific guidance. So it helps, especially the inexperienced, understand what needs to happen to make something reliable. And that sounds like a very traceable, mature way of doing it, unless the organization forgets to update these processes as new technologies and requirements come into play.
Yeah, I think it becomes more and more important to have this kind of discussion and look for methods that can achieve reliability. supplementing or sometimes replacing traditional methods, it becomes more important as you design for reliability. I remember I wrote a paper in 1994 that included design for reliability. It was my first paper that I presented to a conference on the subject. And it was driven by the need to shorten product development time, the need to reduce costs, the need to achieve high reliability. And I was told for years that you get two of the three. You don't get all three. And I go, that doesn't make sense. You need to have all three. And so I started looking for better methods to achieve those three. And it's the whole subject of design for reliability. And you need to move away from merely identifying a reliability requirement and then building samples and testing to a high confidence level without acceleration or even sometimes with. That has to give way to better methods or supplemented by better methods that understand the modeling and the characteristics and the vital few and things like that. And of course, FMEA started accelerating in a lot of companies as the need for design for reliability became more important.
Yeah, and I think there's some analogies with an example I teach in my managing for reliability lesson, and that is there's a study which was done on the design of liquid engine rockets. Rockets with liquid fuel, I should say. And this study, academic study, so quite robust in its approach, looked at two different design approaches. One was an approach where the cost and schedule of the design process, let's call it the initial design process, was minimized, which meant that once you started production or producing, making prototypes, there were a bunch of design issues and failure modes and mechanisms that would become apparent. And then you'd have to have a requirement for substantial engineering support and then subsequent certification to resolve all these issues that weren't really thought of during the very, very short truncated design process. But then they compared it to another approach where you more than doubled the amount of resources you poured into the initial design process, and it was, they called it a more robust design effort. But the effects were astounding. You didn't eliminate all issues associated with prototypes and manufacturing. There were still, once the blueprints were machined for the first time, there are a couple of issues that were found, but it was more than an order of magnitude less. And they found that on average, if you doubled the design effort, you halved the total development schedule because you didn't spend as much time rectifying design faults or issues, and you more than quartered the total development effort, development resource bill. So twice the design effort, one quarter the development effort, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. That's fantastic.
And we see organizations time and time again that just focus on the design effort and not development effort, and look for scapegoats when in a hurried design effort, you really don't have, the poor old designers don't have time to do for makers, or they don't have time to do all these things that we think they should do. They point fingers at these guys who are not doing good work, but they're just not being allowed to flourish because it's a very basic strategic decision, an arbitrary decision to give them no resources to do it right the first time.
Yeah, what comes to mind here is the Dr. Deming. Mm-hmm. I remember one of my favorite quotes from him, and is from one of his books, is, quote, "One gets a good rating for fighting a fire. The result is visible, can be quantified. If you do it right the first time, you're invisible. You satisfied the requirements. That is your job. Mess it up and correct it later, you become a hero," unquote. And what he's saying, of course, there is that this is a cultural thing. Management, companies, groups need to value and create a culture around prevention, because prevention is invisible. This comes back to the tidying topic. If you prevent something, it's not as visible. If it messes up and creates a flap, it becomes the fire is very visible. Mm-hmm. So if you, as a manager or an employee, I don't want to say you shouldn't. Of course, when there's a fire, you need to put it out. But if you're guided by reacting to fires and don't set aside time for prevention, mm-hmm. or as a manager, don't section off certain employees that can focus on prevention, and you work only on firefighting, you're going to have a long and expensive product development process.
And I'll go one step further. You have organizations which have massive field support representative departments and organizations.
Yes.
And when you start to say, let's make something that works for longer for the customer, it's actually an existential crisis for that FSR department. So you have this internal mechanism to say, no, don't make it more reliable, because me and my FSR team need it to fail for us to be able to do our job. And you get this very toxic organizational culture, and that flourishes in very many forms in a surprising number of seemingly profitable organizations that I've come across. But you talk to W. Edwards Deming, and whilst it doesn't have a hugely direct relevance, I would like to throw in my favorite Deming quote, which is, it is not necessary to change. Survival is not mandatory.
That is right.
That is my favorite of all time.
And I like that one. Oh, hey, that might be a good place to end off the conversation.
Yeah. I think for fact, we're quoting Deming, who's been around, obviously he's passed on now, but he started working in this area in the 1950s. The fact that his quotes resonate today as much as they ever have just goes to show that there are some very basic enduring principles to this, basic enduring principles to reliability that have not and will never change, no matter what fad or what tool comes along. It's all about understanding what it is you need to do, and in many cases, making sure you don't hide the problem of product unreliability. And we'd always be interested to see if there's any experiences out there that can be shared. If you do have any experiences, such as having a massive field support a representative department, or any other part of your organisation which would feel threatened if you made your products more reliable, or if there is a systemic issue in your organisation which means that the reliability or unreliability issues never get discussed, please feel free to contact us in the comments section of this podcast. We really treasure the feedback we get. It helps us drive the direction of our future podcasts, and we're talking about things today which are based on your feedback as well. So please keep those comments coming, and I can assure you they certainly get listened to. But beyond that, hey, thanks for taking the time to speak to me today, Carl. It's much appreciated.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay, everyone, until next time, happy reliability engineering.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.